So years ago, before every movie review of every movie was a couple of touches away on your phone on RottenTomatoes.com, and more importantly, when I used to watch movies before I had three kids, you relate, I can see, okay. I had a huge book of every movie reviewed by Roger Ebert, he of Siskel and Ebert, two thumbs up fame. I would read his book and learn about movies that I needed to see, and others that I learned not to bother watching. I learned that I should probably watch This is Spinal Tap, which he gave 4 out of 4 stars, but shouldn't bother with the movie North by the same director about which Ebert wrote, I quote, "I hated this movie, hated, 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 hated this movie, hated it," end quote. He won a Pulitzer Prize, by the way, for criticism, maybe not for that bit of criticism, but one thing Ebert taught me is that in that huge book, other than not to watch North, is that good film criticism is less caring about what a movie is about than how it's about it. For instance, in one film which meant to act as a criticism on the death penalty, a position Ebert held, Ebert gave it 0 stars because it presented its message in such poor taste. Meanwhile, a film much more ambivalent about capital punishment, In Cold Blood, he gave 4 stars. It wasn't what the movie was about, it was how it was about it. So when I was asked to preach on the book of Job and prayer, I remembered Ebert's mantra about movie criticism. What the book of Job says about prayer is something like, it's not so much what you're praying about, it's how you're praying about it. The book of Job is a pretty surprising book for a whole host of reasons. For one thing, it's surprising that it's even in the Bible at all. There are other strange books in the Bible. Esther, for instance, doesn't mention God at all, which is kind of surprising. But Esther's fairly short comparatively to Job, and it still tells a story that fits into the broader narrative of the Bible. That is, Esther is a story about the Jewish people. But Job, at 42 chapters of poetry, is a thick book. Thick as in it takes up a lot of pages, and thick as in very challenging to understand. Now, I was asked to preach a sermon on Job in about 30 minutes, is what I was told. John Calvin did a sermon series on the book of Job that ran about 360 sermons. Over the course of a year, he preached every day on Job, and I imagine they were even longer than 30 minutes. Here I am. This is a bit more challenging, I suppose. I don't know. Maybe it would be more challenging. I would get tired of it, I'm assuming, after a while. But anyway, it tells a story, and a very challenging story, where the main character doesn't really do anything other than talk a lot. And the main character is surprisingly not an Israelite. He's not Jewish. He's not part of the covenant family that pretty much every other book of the Bible is about. And I don't want to highlight that fact any longer than it takes to point out that it makes this strange book just a little stranger. Rather, I want to highlight what I think is a very surprising line in the book of Job, especially for those who have been paying attention to the rest of the book of Job. You can find that line in chapter 42:7, which Yuri read for us, and it's relevant to our topic. It reads, "After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'I am angry with you and your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has.'" This line is hard to square with the previous 41 and a half chapters in this rather long story of a man who spends most of those 41 and a half chapters complaining. Is this the kind of behavior we want modeled for followers of Christ? For instance, at the beginning of the book, after sitting silently for 7 days, Job finally opens his mouth, and this is what he says. "Let the day perish in which I was born, and the night that said a man-child is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, or light shine on it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds settle upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come to the number of the months. Yes, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry be heard in it." Later, during his conversations, I'm not done, later, with his conversations with his friends, he lets out these gems. This is in chapter 6. For the arrows of the Almighty are in me, my spirit drinks their poison, the terrors of God are arrayed against me. And a bit later, that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. This would be my consolation. I would even exult in unrelenting pain, for I have not denied the words of the Holy One. Here are some lines Job says directly to God. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are a breath. What are human beings that you make so much of them, that you set your mind on them, visit them every morning, test them every moment? Will you not look away from me for a while? Let me alone until I swallow my spittle? If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of humanity? Why have you made me your target? Afterward, God appears to Job in a storm, where, by the way, God doesn't seem really too happy to see Job. God's speech is mainly made up of sarcastic rebukes. Anyway, after God's speeches from the storm, Job's response shows that Job has been chastened. We heard this earlier. I know you can do all things, Job says, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me. I had heard you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. In this little response to God, Job admits to speaking out of ignorance and then repents. By contrast, let's hear a little of what Job's friends have to say in response to Job's complaints. This is what Job's friend Eliphaz says in chapter 5. As for me, I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause. He's saying this to Job. This is what I would do if I were in your situation. He does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. He gives rain on the earth and sends waters on the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. That sounds like it could have been reading from the Psalter. Here's a response from Bildad, his friend, Bildad the Shuhite. If you will seek God and make supplication to the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore you to your rightful place. And here's a little from his third friend, Zophar. Can you find out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limit of the Almighty? It is higher than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? Its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. Now, generally, Zophar the Naamathite, who that last line is from, is a bit more hot-headed than his other friends. But these lines sure sound an awful lot like God himself, who answers Job from the storm in chapter 38. To prove it, here are the first lines from God's speech. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determines its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? All of this, that is, evidence from chapter 3 to 42, is to say that you'd be forgiven for thinking the previous line was a mistake that I read earlier, the line where God says that Job spoke right, but that his friends did not. You'd be forgiven for thinking that Job did not speak right, and that Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar did, at least when talking about God. After all, Job repented of his words, and his friends defended God. But then, before you finish thinking that, God continues speaking. So now, take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and sacrifice a burnt offering for yourselves. My servant Job will pray for you, and I will accept his prayer and not deal with you according to your folly. You have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Just to make sure you didn't think the author or editor was making a mistake, God says the exact same thing again. I think we can be sure that this line, you did not speak right as my servant Job has, is supposed to be in there, however surprising it seems. Such a statement is something that we should explore more closely, I think, since it fits right in the theme of prayer. Notice that God tells Eliphaz that Job will pray for him. We heard some of Job's prayers earlier. Is that the kind of person you want praying for you? I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are a breath. What if I told you the answer is yes? This is the kind of person you want praying for you. To explain, let's go back to the beginning. Job's a tough book. It helps to go through it a few times. This won't be our last, it turns out. Here is the story of Job as a reminder. Job lives in the land of Uz, looks like Uz, it's pronounced Uz, where he has clearly led a blessed life. He has much livestock and land. He has 7 children. He's also very, I don't know if that's a blessing or not, to tell you the truth. I have 3, but 3 is great. But they seem to think that back then. Okay, so he's also very pious, concerning himself over his children's piety as well, sacrificing and praying for them on a regular basis. Little does he know about a wager in heaven between God and a mysterious character named Satan in all of our Bibles, but who is in fact much more ambiguous than that. This is not the place to get into that right now. 360 sermons, remember, by John Kelsey. This Satan character acknowledges that Job is the greatest of all the people in the East. He is blameless and upright, fearing God and turning from evil, but suggests that Job is so pious because God has made it easy on him. Of course he worships a God who has provided him with such an easy life. If you really want to test his piety, strip him of all that he has, all those reasons he might think that he's blessed. Then, I bet you, he'll curse you to your face. For some reason, a reason neither we nor Job ever find out, God goes along with this plan. And in a very brief amount of time, Job loses all that he has in a variety of ways. He loses livestock through marauding Sabaeans and Chaldeans, so people from elsewhere. He loses sheep and servants through what is called a fire from God. And he loses the lives of his children through a great wind. But God is right. Job does not curse God. In fact, he puts no blame on God in a brief proverb or poem, a famous one. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The story would seem to be over, but the wager is repeated again. This time, the Satan goes after Job's body. Job is covered in excruciating boils so that he can only sit in silence and scrape himself with shards of pottery. His wife believes that God has somehow done this to him and tells Job to curse God and die, but Job maintains his integrity through it all. And meanwhile, his friends come from other lands and cannot even recognize him. He's so beaten up. They all just sit in silence for a week until finally Job explodes in rage. In rage. This is where Job calls on the destruction of the day he was born, that we recited earlier. And his friends, who were patient enough with him to sit beside Job in silence for a good week, are now a bit perturbed by this outburst. For it sounds like Job is blaming God for all of his problems, and they can't stand for that. So begins a very long argument between Job and his friends. It's a pretty strange argument as arguments go, because each person gets a turn to speak and does so in poetry, but it still gets pretty heated, all things considered. The gist of the argument is this. Job believes that he is being punished by God unjustly, claiming he did nothing to deserve his suffering. His friends say that such a thing is impossible. God is a just God, doling out just punishment. Therefore, if you are suffering, it must be because you have sinned. There are other points, of course. The argument goes on for pages, and there are 4 people involved. But the gist is that Job believes he is innocent and that God must be guilty, while his friends believe that God must be innocent because he is God, and so Job, therefore, must be guilty. What the friends and Job don't know is what we know. The reason Job is suffering is because he's innocent. He's not being punished at all, for this all stems from the wager between God and Satan, where they were arguing over Job's devotion to God and whether his devotion was due to Job having a hedge protecting him. To recap up to this point, God says that Job was devoted to God freely, and says for not, so for no reason. Satan says that Job was devoted to God only because God provided him with things. Satan took those things away. Now Job believes that God has punished Job freely, for naught, as it were. And Job's friends say that God must have taken away those things because Job did something wrong. Looking at this quick summary, perhaps we can begin to answer the question, what did Job's friends say that was wrong? After all, if Job lost all he had because of his innocence, but his friends insisted he must be guilty in order to have received these ills, Job's friends are speaking wrong about God. But hey, at least they were defending God, right? I mean, Zophar pretty much quoted God even before God said it. But sure, for the sake of argument, let's say that they didn't speak right about God. But we haven't figured out what Job said that is right about God. Remember, Job believes he is being punished unjustly by God, when that isn't correct at all. Job is right that he didn't do anything wrong, but not quite right otherwise, because he believes that he is being punished. This here is where Roger Ebert's tip on film criticism comes in. It's not what the movie is about, it's how the movie is about it. In the case of Job and his friends, it's not about what they are praying about, it's how they are praying about it. When we look more closely at the praying itself, this becomes more evident. For the closer we read, you'll see that after this tragedy, Job is the only character in the book who actually prays at all. In fact, the way this very ordered argument goes is this. Eliphaz argues with Job. Then Job responds to Eliphaz. Then Job complains to God. Then Bildad argues with Job. Then Job responds to Bildad. Then Job complains to God. Then Zophaz argues with Job. Then Job responds to Zophar. Then Job complains to God. And this is repeated two more times. And Job, in all of his speeches, changes his focus halfway through from his friends to God. Job may very well be wrong in what he's saying, and his friends may be right in some parts. But as theologian Karl Barth puts it, Job is right in his wrongness, and his friends are wrong in their rightness. I come from a tradition where such a sentiment seems out of place. Orthodoxy, that is, literally speaking rightly, as Job did, apparently, is held in high regards in circles I come from. Heresy is a big problem that 500 years or so ago could have ended in death. It's very often ended in death. And you can see Job's friends inching towards this sentiment at times. They may not be ready to kill Job for his heresy or blasphemy, but they are not happy. Zophar. Though the pride of this godless person, to be understood as Job, reaches to the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he will perish forever like his own dung. It's a colorful book. One time, Zophar says, "Evil is in your mouth." Because of this evil, Zophar continues, "Terrors will come over him. Total darkness lies in wait for his treasures. A fire unfanned will consume him and devour what is left in his tent." Sounds pretty harsh, but you might say that Zophar's heart is in the right place. Remember, he's defending God's honor here. But this is not what is important in the eyes of God, according to the book of Job as a whole. God does not need defending. Rather, he wants honest engagement. It is much more honorable to presume God can handle your tough questions. Remember the wager at the beginning of the book. Satan wants to know if Job can be devoted to God under any circumstances, and when all that Job has is stripped from him, what is Job's response? It is never to abandon God. It is to ask why. In the most honest and angry language he can summon. He doesn't make excuses. He doesn't chalk it up to God making some kind of mistake or forgetting about him. He places all the blame on God and doesn't relent until he gets a face-to-face meeting with the divine. And this seems to be what prayer is about. This seems to be what speaking rightly about God is. It's not going through the motions. Going through the motions is what the friends do. I'm sure we can all come up with some senseless tragedy we've experienced in our lives. In my neighborhood in Vancouver, kind of in the Chinatown area, we've been consumed with the loss of a 19-year-old man. I've known Dakota for several years. He was a very gentle kid. He was also a young father to a baby boy. About 2 weeks ago, I woke up one morning and my wife, Melanie, told me that he was murdered the night before on the corner, just a few hundred feet from our house, sorry. The police said it was a targeted killing, and we soon found out that the culprit was a former friend of his. The loss couldn't be much more tragic. Here was a young man with his whole life ahead of him, killed by a friend and left to die alone on the street corner, and now his son will grow up without a father, his sister without a brother, and this other kid, the culprit, has ruined his own life. There's nothing good that has come from this. There's plenty of blame to go around. But I cannot imagine how anyone's life will be better because of this event. It's the very epitome of a senseless death. The last couple of weeks have had their fair share of senseless deaths. And like with Job's property, some stem from the activity of human action and some from what insurance companies called acts of God. Mass murder in Christchurch in New England, the cyclones in Mozambique, just to name two. So what's the proper response to these atrocities then? Job's is. This is what I think the book of Job says about prayer, that it's right to be angry. It's right to ask why. It's right to be unsettled and wonder about the justice of it all. It may seem uncomfortable to us who believe in God, who count ourselves Christ followers. We believe that God is all-powerful and good, and so we feel uncomfortable blaming God for the terrible things we experience or witness in this life. But this is what the Bible teaches is the right response. It's not just the book of Job that teaches this response either. There is an entire book called Lamentations. And the book of Psalms has some very dark poetry in it that would surprise most people who attend church but don't read the Bible. Psalm 39 ends with this prayer to God. Look away from me that I may enjoy life again before I depart and am no more. That's the last line. Here's the ending of Psalm 89. Remember, Lord, how your servant has been mocked, how I bear in my heart the taunts of all the nations, the taunts with which your enemies, Lord, have mocked, with which they have mocked every step of your anointed one. And that's the end. Psalm 88 is almost despairing with its conclusion. You have taken from me friend and neighbor. Darkness is my closest friend. But perhaps the most famous of all laments comes at the beginning of Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? We don't really know it from the Psalter, though. We know it from Jesus, God's Son himself. Jesus is our true model of faith. He of his sinless, self-giving life. He of the promise of resurrection we will all experience one day. He, even Jesus, however, offers us a model of lament that is reminiscent of Job. If we wondered how Job could have spoken right after his 30-plus chapters of whining and complaining and blaming God for his suffering, we can be assured that he does speak right because we see the most righteous person ever to have lived using similar language. Of course, we know what happens. Jesus dies, even after his righteous complaint. The prayer is not magical. God's angels don't come down as Jesus is dying on the cross to save him, but there is hope. Jesus does rise again, even and especially after his complaint to God. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.